Chapter 25, written with Anne Drian. Real patriots ask questions. It is not the function of our government to keep the citizen from falling into error. It is the function of the citizen to keep the government from falling into error. U.S. Supreme Court Justice Robert H. Jackson, 1950. It is a fact of life on our beleaguered little planet that widespread torture, famine, and governmental criminal irresponsibility are much more likely to be found in tyrannical than in democratic governments. Why? Because the rulers of the former are much less likely to be thrown out of office for their misdeeds than the rulers of the latter. This is error-correcting machinery in politics. The methods of science, with all its imperfections, can be used to improve social, political, and economic systems, and this is, I think, true no matter what criterion of improvement is adopted. How is this possible if science is based on experiment? Humans are not electrons or laboratory rats. But every act of Congress, every Supreme Court decision, every presidential national security directive, every change in the prime rate is an experiment. Every shift in economic policy, every increase or decrease in funding for Head Start, every toughening of criminal sentences is an experiment. Exchanging needles, making condoms freely available, or decriminalizing marijuana are all experiments. Doing nothing to help Abyssinia against Italy or to prevent Nazi Germany from invading the Rhineland was an experiment. Communism in Eastern Europe, the Soviet Union, and China was an experiment. Privatizing mental health care or prisons is an experiment. Japan and West Germany investing a great deal in science and technology and next to nothing on defense and finding that their economies boomed was an experiment. Handguns are available for self-protection in Seattle, but not in nearby Vancouver, Canada. Handgun killings are 5 times more common in Seattle, and the handgun suicide rate is 10 times greater in Seattle. Guns make impulsive killing easy. This is also an experiment. In almost all of these cases, adequate control experiments are not performed, or variables are insufficiently separated. Nevertheless, to a certain and often useful degree, policy ideas can be tested. The great waste would be to ignore the results of social experiments because they seem to be ideologically unpalatable. There is no nation on earth today optimized for the middle of the 21st century. We face an abundance of subtle and complex problems. We need, therefore, subtle and complex solutions. Since there is no deductive theory of social organization, our only recourse is scientific experiment, trying out sometimes on small scales, community, city, and state level, say, a wide range of alternatives. One of the perquisites of power on becoming prime minister in China in the 5th century BC was that you got to construct a model state in your home district or province. It was Confucius' chief life failing, he lamented, that he never got to try. Even a casual scrutiny of history reveals that we humans have a sad tendency to make the same mistakes again and again. We're afraid of strangers or anybody who's a little different from us. When we get scared, we start pushing people around. We have readily accessible buttons that release powerful emotions when pressed. We can be manipulated into utter senselessness by clever politicians. Give us the right kind of leader, and, like the most suggestible subjects of the hypnotherapists, we'll gladly do just about anything he wants, even things we know to be wrong. The framers of the Constitution were students of history. In recognition of the human condition, they sought to invent a means that would keep us free in spite of ourselves. Some of the opponents of the U.S. Constitution insisted that it would never work, that a republican form of government spanning a land with such dissimilar climates, economies, morals, politics, and peoples, as Governor George Clinton of New York said, was impossible, that such a government and such a constitution, as Patrick Henry of Virginia declared, contradicts all the experience of the world. The experiment was tried anyway. Scientific findings and attitudes were common in those who invented the United States. The supreme authority, outranking any personal opinion, any book, any revelation, was, as the Declaration of Independence puts it, the laws of nature and of nature's God. Dr. Benjamin Franklin was revered in Europe and America as the founder of the new field of electrical physics. At the Constitutional Convention of 1789, John Adams repeatedly appealed to the analogy of mechanical balance in machines, others to William Harvey's discovery of the circulation of the blood. Late in life, Adams wrote, "All mankind are chemists from their cradles to their graves. The material universe is a chemical experiment." James Madison used chemical and biological metaphors in the Federalist Papers. The American revolutionaries were creatures of the European Enlightenment, which provides an essential background for understanding the origins and purpose of the United States. Science and its philosophical corollaries, wrote the American historian Clinton Rossiter, were perhaps the most important intellectual force shaping the destiny of 18th century America. Franklin was only one of a number of forward-looking colonists who recognized the kinship of scientific method and democratic procedure. Free inquiry, free exchange of information, optimism, self-criticism, pragmatism, objectivity, all these ingredients of the coming republic were already active in the republic of science that flourished in the 18th century. Thomas Jefferson was a scientist. That's how he described himself. When you visit his home at Monticello, Virginia, the moment you enter its portals, you find ample evidence of his scientific interests. Not just in his immense and varied library, but in copying machines, automatic doors, telescopes, and other instruments, some at the cutting edge of early 19th century technology. Some he invented, some he copied, some he purchased. He compared the plants and animals of America with Europe's, uncovered fossils, used the calculus in the design of a new plow. He mastered Newtonian physics. Nature destined him, he said, to be a scientist, but there were no opportunities for scientists in pre-revolutionary Virginia. Other, more urgent needs took precedence. He threw himself into the historic events that were transpiring around him. Once independence was won, he said, later generations could devote themselves to science and scholarship. Jefferson was an early hero of mine, not because of his scientific interests, although they very much helped to mold his political philosophy, but because he, almost more than anyone else, was responsible for the spread of democracy throughout the world. The idea, breathtaking, radical, and revolutionary at the time, in many places in the world it still is that not kings, not priests, not big city bosses, not dictators, not a military cabal, not a de facto conspiracy of the wealthy, but ordinary people working together are to rule the nations. Not only was Jefferson a leading theoretician of this cause, he was also involved in the most practical way, helping to bring about the great American political experiment that has, all over the world, been admired and emulated since. He died at Monticello on July 4, 1826, 50 years to the day after the colonies issued that stirring document written by Jefferson called the Declaration of Independence. It was denounced by conservatives worldwide. Monarchy, aristocracy, and state-supported religion, that's what conservatives were defending then. In a letter composed a few days before his death, he wrote that it was the light of science that had demonstrated that the mass of mankind has not been born with saddles on their backs, nor were a favored few born booted and spurred. He had written in the Declaration of Independence that we all must have the same opportunities, the same unalienable rights. And if the definition of all was disgracefully incomplete in 1776, the spirit of the Declaration was generous enough that today all is far more inclusive. Jefferson was a student of history, not just the compliant and safe history that praises our own time or country or ethnic group, but the real history of real humans, our weaknesses as well as our strengths. History taught him that the rich and powerful will steal and oppress if given half a chance. He described the governments of Europe, which he saw at first hand as the American ambassador to France. Under the pretense of government, he said, they had divided their nations into two classes, wolves and sheep. Jefferson taught that every government degenerates when it is left to the rulers alone, because rulers, by the very act of ruling, misuse the public trust. The people themselves, he said, are the only prudent repository of power. But he worried that the people, and the argument goes back to Thucydides and Aristotle, are easily misled. So he advocated safeguards, insurance policies. One was the constitutional separation of powers. Accordingly, various groups, some pursuing their own selfish interests, balance one another, preventing any one of them from running away with the country. The executive, legislative, and judicial branches, the House and the Senate, the states and the federal government. He also stressed, passionately and repeatedly, that it was essential for the people to understand the risks and benefits of government, to educate themselves, and to involve themselves in the political process. Without that, he said, the wolves will take over. Here's how he put it in Notes on Virginia, stressing how the powerful and unscrupulous find zones of vulnerability they can exploit. In every government on earth is some trace of human weakness, some germ of corruption and degeneracy. which cunning will discover and wickedness insensibly open, cultivate, and improve. Every government degenerates when trusted to the rulers of the people alone. The people themselves, therefore, are its only safe depositories. And to render even them safe, their minds must be improved. Jefferson had little to do with the actual writing of the U.S. Constitution. As it was being formulated, he was serving as American minister to France. When he read its provisions, he was pleased, but with two reservations. One deficiency: no limit was provided on the number of terms the president could serve. This, Jefferson feared, was a way for a president to become a king, in fact, if not in law. The other major deficiency was the absence of a Bill of Rights. The citizen, the average person, was insufficiently protected, Jefferson thought, from the inevitable abuses of those in power. He advocated freedom of speech, in part so that even wildly unpopular views could be expressed, so that deviations from the conventional wisdom could be offered for consideration. Personally, he was an extremely amiable man, reluctant to criticize even his sworn enemies. He displayed a bust of his arch-adversary Alexander Hamilton in the vestibule at Monticello. Nevertheless, he believed that the habit of skepticism is an essential prerequisite for responsible citizenship. He argued that the cost of education is trivial compared to the cost of ignorance, of leaving the government to the wolves. He taught that the country is safe only when the people rule. Part of the duty of citizenship is not to be intimidated into conformity. I wish that the oath of citizenship taken by recent immigrants and the pledge that students routinely recite included something like, "I promise to question everything my leaders tell me." That would be really to Thomas Jefferson's point. "I promise to use my critical faculties. I promise to develop my independence of thought. I promise to educate myself so I can make my own judgments." I also wish that the Pledge of Allegiance were directed at the Constitution and the Bill of Rights, as it is when the President takes his oath of office, rather than to the flag and the nation. When we consider the founders of our nation, Jefferson, Washington, Samuel and John Adams, Madison and Monroe, Benjamin Franklin, Tom Paine, and many others, we have before us a list of at least 10 and maybe even dozens of great political leaders. They were well educated. Products of the European Enlightenment, they were students of history. They knew human fallibility and weakness and corruptibility. They were fluent in the English language. They wrote their own speeches. They were realistic and practical, and at the same time motivated by high principles. They were not checking the pollsters on what to think this week. They knew what to think. They were comfortable with long-term thinking, planning even further ahead than the next election. They were self-sufficient, not requiring careers as politicians or lobbyists to make a living. They were able to bring out the best in us. They were interested in, and at least two of them, fluent in science. They attempted to set a course for the United States into the far future, not so much by establishing laws as by setting limits on what kinds of laws could be passed. The Constitution and its Bill of Rights have done remarkably well, constituting, despite human weaknesses, a machine able, more often than not, to correct its own trajectory. At that time, there were only about 2.5 million citizens of the United States. Today, there are about 100 times more. So if there were 10 people of the caliber of Thomas Jefferson then, there ought to be 10 times 100 equals 1,000 Thomas Jeffersons today. Where are they? One reason the Constitution is a daring and courageous document is that it allows for continuing change, even of the form of government itself, if the people so wish. Because no one is wise enough to foresee which ideas may answer urgent societal needs, even if they're counterintuitive and have been troubling in the past. This document tries to guarantee the fullest and freest expression of views. There is, of course, a price. Most of us are for freedom of expression when there's a danger that our own views will be suppressed. We're not all that upset, though, when views we despise encounter a little censorship here and there. But within certain narrowly circumscribed limits, Justice Oliver Wendell Holmes's famous example was causing panic by falsely crying fire in a crowded theater, great liberties are permitted in America. Gun collectors are free to use portraits of the Chief Justice, the Speaker of the House, or the Director of the FBI for target practice. Outraged, civic-minded citizens are free to burn in effigy the President of the United States. Even if they mock Judeo-Christian Islamic values, even if they ridicule everything most of us hold dear, devil worshippers, if there are any, are entitled to practice their religion, so long as they break no constitutionally valid law. A purported scientific article or popular book asserting the superiority of one race over another may not be censored by the government, no matter how pernicious it is. The cure for a fallacious argument is a better argument, not the suppression of ideas. Individuals or groups are free to argue that a Jewish or Masonic conspiracy is taking over the world, or that the federal government is in league with the devil. Individuals may, if they wish, praise the lives and politics of such undisputed mass murderers as Adolf Hitler, Joseph Stalin, and Mao Zedong. Even detestable opinions have a right to be heard. The system founded by Jefferson, Madison, and their colleagues offers means of expression to those who do not understand its origins and wish to replace it by something very different. For example, Tom Clark, Attorney General and therefore Chief Law Enforcement Officer of the United States, in 1948 offered this suggestion: those who do not believe in the ideology of the United States shall not be allowed to stay in the United States. But if there is one key and characteristic U.S. ideology, it is that there are no mandatory and no forbidden ideologies. Some more recent 1990s cases. John Brockhoft, in jail for bombing an abortion clinic in Cincinnati, wrote in a pro-life newsletter, "I'm a very narrow-minded, intolerant, reactionary, Bible-thumping fundamentalist, a zealot and fanatic. The reason the United States was once a great nation, besides being blessed by God, is because she was founded on truth, justice, and narrow-mindedness." Randall Terry, founder of Operation Rescue, an organization that blockades abortion clinics, told a congregation in August 1993, "Let a wave of intolerance wash over you. Yes, hate is good. Our goal is a Christian nation. We are called by God to conquer this country. We don't want pluralism." The expression of such views is protected, and properly so, under the Bill of Rights, even if those protected would abolish the Bill of Rights if they got the chance. The protection for the rest of us is to use that same Bill of Rights to get across to every citizen the indispensability of the Bill of Rights. What means to protect themselves against human fallibility? What error protection machinery do these alternative doctrines and institutions offer? An infallible leader? Race? Nationalism? Wholesale disengagement from civilization, except for explosives and automatic weapons? How can they be sure, especially in the darkness of the 20th century? Don't they need candles? In his celebrated little book on liberty, the English philosopher John Stuart Mill argued that silencing an opinion is a peculiar evil. If the opinion is right, we are robbed of the opportunity of exchanging error for truth. And if it's wrong, we are deprived of a deeper understanding of the truth in its collision with error. If we know only our side of the argument, we hardly know even that. It becomes stale, soon learned only by rote, untested, a pallid and lifeless truth. Mill also wrote, "If society lets any considerable number of its members grow up as mere children, incapable of being acted on by rational consideration of distant motives, society has itself to blame." Jefferson made the same point even more strongly. If a nation expects to be both ignorant and free in a state of civilization, it expects what never was and never will be. In a letter to Madison, he continued the thought, "A society that will trade a little liberty for a little order will lose both, and deserve neither." When permitted to listen to alternative opinions and engage in substantive debate, people have been known to change their minds. It can happen. For example, Hugo Black, in his youth, was a member of the Ku Klux Klan. He later became a Supreme Court justice and was one of the leaders in the historic Supreme Court decisions, partly based on the 14th Amendment to the Constitution, that affirmed the civil rights of all Americans. It was said that when he was a young man, he dressed up in white robes and scared black folks. When he got older, he dressed up in black robes and scared white folks. In matters of criminal justice, the Bill of Rights recognizes the temptation that may be felt by police, prosecutors, and the judiciary to intimidate witnesses and expedite punishment. The criminal justice system is fallible. Innocent people might be punished for crimes they did not commit. Governments are perfectly capable of framing those who, for reasons unconnected with the purported crime, they do not like. So the Bill of Rights protects defendants. A kind of cost-benefit analysis is made. The guilty may on occasion be set free, so that the innocent will not be punished. This is not only a moral virtue. It also inhibits the misuse of the criminal justice system to suppress unpopular opinions or despised minorities. It is part of the error correction machinery. New ideas, invention, and creativity in general always spearhead a kind of freedom, a breaking out from hobbling constraints. Freedom is a prerequisite for continuing the delicate experiment of science, which is one reason the Soviet Union could not remain a totalitarian state and be technologically competitive. At the same time, science, or rather its delicate mix of openness and skepticism and its encouragement of diversity and debate, is a prerequisite for continuing the delicate experiment of freedom in an industrial and highly technological society. Once you've questioned the religious insistence on the prevailing view that the Earth was at the center of the universe, why should you accept the repeated and confident assertions by religious leaders that God sent kings to rule over us? In the 17th century, it was easy to whip English and colonial juries into a frenzy over this impiety or that heresy. They were willing to torture people to death for their beliefs. By the late 18th century, they weren't so sure. Rossiter again, from Seed Time of the Republic, 1953. Under the pressure of the American environment, Christianity grew more humanistic and temperate, more tolerant with the struggle of the sects, more liberal with the growth of optimism and rationalism, more experimental with the rise of science, more individualistic with the advent of democracy. Equally important, increasing numbers of colonists, as a legion of preachers loudly lamented, were turning secular in curiosity and skeptical in attitude. The Bill of Rights decoupled religion from the state, in part because so many religions were steeped in an absolutist frame of mind, each convinced that it alone had a monopoly on the truth and therefore eager for the state to impose this truth on others. Often, the leaders and practitioners of absolutist religions were unable to perceive any middle ground or recognize that the truth might draw upon and embrace apparently contradictory doctrines. The framers of the Bill of Rights had before them the example of England, where the ecclesiastical crime of heresy and the secular crime of treason had become nearly indistinguishable. Many of the early colonists had come to America fleeing religious persecution, although some of them were perfectly happy to persecute other people for their beliefs. The founders of our nation recognized that a close relation between the government and any of the quarrelsome religions would be fatal to freedom and injurious to religion. Justice Black, in the Supreme Court decision Engle v. Vitale, 1962, described the Establishment Clause of the First Amendment this way. Its first and most immediate purpose rested on the belief that a union of government and religion tends to destroy government and degrade religion. Moreover, here too the separation of powers works. Each sect and cult, as Walter Savage Landor once noted, is a moral check on the others. Competition is as wholesome in religion as in commerce. But the price is high. This competition is an impediment to religious bodies acting in concert to address the common good. Rossiter concludes, "The twin doctrines of separation of church and state and liberty of individual conscience are the marrow of our democracy, if not indeed America's most magnificent contribution to the freeing of Western man." Now, it's no good to have such rights if they're not used. A right of free speech when no one contradicts the government, freedom of the press when no one is willing to ask the tough questions, a right of assembly when there are no protests, universal suffrage when less than half the electorate votes, separation of church and state when the wall of separation is not regularly repaired. Through disuse, they can become no more than votive objects, patriotic lip service, rights and freedoms, use them or lose them. Due to the foresight of the framers of the Bill of Rights, and even more so to all those who, at considerable personal risk, insisted on exercising those rights, it's hard now to bottle up free speech. School library committees, the immigration service, the police, the FBI, or the ambitious politician looking to score cheap votes may attempt it from time to time, but sooner or later the cork pops. The Constitution is, after all, the law of the land. Public officials are sworn to uphold it, and activists and the courts episodically hold their feet to the fire. However, through lowered educational standards, declining intellectual competence, diminished zest for substantive debate, and social sanctions against skepticism, our liberties can be slowly eroded and our rights subverted. The founders understood this well. The time for fixing every essential right on a legal basis is while our rulers are honest and ourselves united, said Thomas Jefferson. From the conclusion of this revolutionary war, we shall be going downhill. It will not then be necessary to resort every moment to the people for support. They will be forgotten, therefore, and their rights disregarded. They will forget themselves but in the sole faculty of making money, and will never think of uniting to effect a due respect for their rights. The shackles, therefore, which shall not be knocked off at the conclusion of this war, will remain on us long, will be made heavier and heavier, till our rights shall revive or expire in a convulsion. Education on the value of free speech and the other freedoms reserved by the Bill of Rights, about what happens when you don't have them, and about how to exercise and protect them, should be an essential prerequisite for being an American citizen, or indeed a citizen of any nation, the more so to the degree that such rights remain unprotected. If we can't think for ourselves, if we're unwilling to question authority, then we're just putty in the hands of those in power. But if the citizens are educated and form their own opinions, then those in power work for us. In every country, we should be teaching our children the scientific method and the reasons for a Bill of Rights. With it comes a certain decency, humility, and community spirit. In the demon-haunted world that we inhabit by virtue of being human, this may be all that stands between us and the enveloping darkness. Acknowledgements. It has been my great pleasure over many years to teach a senior seminar on critical thinking at Cornell University. I've been able to select students from all over the university on the basis both of ability and of cultural and disciplinary diversity. We stress written assignments and oral argumentation. Towards the end of the course, students select a range of wildly controversial social issues in which they have major emotional investments. Paired two by two, they prepare for a succession of end-of-semester oral debates. A few weeks before the debates, however, they are informed that it is the task of each to present the point of view of the opponent in a way that's satisfactory to the opponent. So the opponent will say, "Yes, that's a fair presentation of my views." In the joint written debate, they explore their differences, but also how the debate process has helped them to better understand the opposing point of view. Some of the topics in this book were first presented to these students. I have learned much from their reception and criticism of my ideas, and want to thank them here. I'm also grateful to Cornell's Department of Astronomy and its chair, Jovan Terzian, for permitting me to teach the course, which, although labeled Astronomy 490, presents only a little astronomy. Some of this book has also been presented in Parade magazine, a supplement to Sunday newspapers all over North America, with some 83 million readers each week. The vigorous feedback I've received from Parade readers has greatly enhanced my understanding of the issues described in this book and the variety of public attitudes. I have in several places excerpted some of my mail from Parade readers, which, it seems to me, has provided a kind of finger on the pulse of the citizenry of the United States. The editor-in-chief of Parade, Walter Anderson, and the senior editor, David Currier, as well as the editorial and research staff of this remarkable magazine, have in many cases greatly improved my presentation. They also have permitted opinions to be expressed that might not have made it into print in mass-market publications less dedicated to the First Amendment of the U.S. Constitution. Some portions of the text first appeared in the Washington Post and the New York Times. The last chapter is based in part on an address I had the pleasure of delivering on July 4, 1992, from the East Portico at Monticello, the back of the nickel, on the occasion of the induction to U.S. citizenship of people from 31 other nations. My opinions on democracy, the method of science, and public education have been influenced by enormous numbers of people over the years, many of whom I mention in the body of the text. But I would like to single out here the inspiration I've received from Martin Gardner, Isaac Asimov, Philip Morrison, and Henry Steele Commager. There is not room to thank the many others who have helped provide understanding and lucid examples, or who have corrected errors of omission or commission. But I want them all to know how deeply grateful I am to them. I must, however, explicitly thank the following friends and colleagues for critically reviewing all or part of earlier drafts of this book: Bill Aldridge, Susan Blackmore, William Cromer, Fred Frankel, Kendrick Frazier, Martin Gardner, Ira Glasser, Fred Golden, Kurt Gottfried, Lester Grinspoon, Philip Klass, Paul Kurtz, Elizabeth Loftus, David Morrison, Richard Ofshi, Jay Aurier, Albert Pennybacker, Frank Press, James Randi, Theodore Rojak, Dorian Sagan, David Saperstein, Robert Seipel, Stephen Soter, Jeremy Stone, Peter Sturrock, and Jervant Terzian. I also am very grateful to my literary agent, Morton Janklow, and members of his staff for wise counsel, Anne Godoff and others responsible for the production process at Random House, Enrica Gadler, J.K. Lambert, and Kathy Rosenblum. William Barnett for ushering the manuscript through its final phases. Andrea Barnett, Laurel Parker, Karen Gobrecht, Cindy Vita Vogel, Ginny Ryan, and Christopher Rusa for their assistance. And the Cornell Library System, including the rare books collection on mysticism and superstition, originally compiled by the university's first president, Andrew Dixon White. Parts of four of the chapters in this book were written with my wife and longtime collaborator, Ann Drian, who is also the elected secretary of the Federation of American Scientists, an organization founded in 1945 by the original Manhattan Project scientists to monitor the ethical use of science and high technology. She has also provided enormously helpful guidance, suggestions, and criticism on content and style throughout the book and at every stage of writing it over the course of nearly a decade. I have learned from her more than I can say. I know how lucky I am to find in the same person someone whose advice and judgment, sense of humor, and courageous vision I so much admire, who is also the love of my life. Addenda. In the January 5, 1996 issue of Science, the Herrnstein-Murray book, The Bell Curve, pages 360 to 361, is criticized by members of a National Institute of Health committee concerned with the ethical, legal, and social implications of genetic determinism. They stress, one, environmental as well as genetic influences on intelligence, two, even traits that are highly heritable can be strongly affected by the environment, and three, the inheritance of complex traits such as intelligence is unpredictable. The committee deplores the bell curve and characterizes its conclusion as unjustifiable and dangerous. Further on the association of acetaminophens and kidney failure. The discussion on page 208 is based on a scientific report published in the December 22, 1994 New England Journal of Medicine by a team of medical scientists from Johns Hopkins University and the University of Geneva. Their conclusion? People who often take acetaminophen have an increased risk of ESRD, end-stage renal disease, necessitating dialysis and/or kidney transplant, but not those who often take aspirin. The scientists estimate that 8 to 10% of the number of new cases of ESRD each year come from patients taking 1 to 3 acetaminophen tablets a day for a year or more. Since there are, according to the National Kidney Foundation, some 50,000 annual new cases of ESRD, and since there are other causes of kidney failure, it follows that some 0.1 times 50,000 equals 5,000 new cases of ESRD may arise each year because of acetaminophen. Although the study did not single out any particular brand, there are no essential pharmaceutical differences among the various brands of acetaminophen. Tylenol is by far the largest selling brand of acetaminophen. There is some possibility that this study represents a case of correlation without causation, but to me, the control experiments suggest otherwise. Nicole Althaus, the Pennsylvania teenager whose case is described on page 166, began making her accusations against her father and others in February of 1991. All charges against Mr. Althaus were dropped in April 1992 when Nicole refused to testify against her father, and the prosecution came to an end. Nicole publicly recanted her various allegations about both parents a few months later and moved back into their home. Mr. and Mrs. Althaus and Nicole filed a civil suit against the psychiatrist and clinic to whom Nicole was referred shortly after she began her accusations. The Althauses charged that the psychiatrist had failed to properly evaluate Nicole's allegations of abuse. The jury awarded $213,899 to Mr. Althaus, who, upon his arrest in 1991, had been jailed for a weekend before being released pending trial, and his wife, and awarded $58,333 to Nicole.
We hope you have enjoyed our presentation of The Demon-Haunted World, Science as a Candle in the Dark, by Carl Sagan, copyright 1995 by Carl Sagan, and performance copyright 1996 by Brilliance Corporation, all rights reserved. For further information concerning this program or other book cassette titles, please call the following toll-free number, 1-800-222-3225.